I was in the Maryland Penitentiary at 954 Forest Street, which was a maximum security facility, the same one that all the lifers was at. That's where they held me at. And I had no prior convictions at the age of 17. Yes, I was there.
Hi, I'm DeMarco, and you're listening to Actual Innocence, a podcast bringing awareness to wrongful convictions and problems with the justice system. I'm here with my amazing co-host, Brooke. How are you doing this week, Brooke?
I am doing really well. I'm getting ready for Christmas. My cats were watching me put up the Christmas tree, so I decided to just throw all the ornaments behind the tree to save them the trouble.
That's funny. I actually have my Christmas tree up as well and a few presents under there.
We got a lot of snow. Do you have snow there?
No, you have snow?
Yeah, we have a lot.
No, I'm not ready for snow yet.
So today's episode is the second part of our interview with Leslie Vass. So if you haven't listened to the first part, you might want to go back and do that first. DeMarco, can you give the listeners a little recap of the previous episode?
Leslie was a 17-year-old kid who had never had an interaction with police before. He had a trial by judge, and he seems to be a genuinely good guy. So if you haven't heard part one, y'all need to go listen to that.
So I want to talk for a minute about our sponsors. We are so grateful to all of our sponsors for the support and to you for supporting them. But we also wanted to make sure that you know, we only endorse sponsors that we really believe in. We've actually turned down sponsors that we didn't feel were supportive of our goals.
Today we have three sponsors, SeatGeek, Away, and Bombas, one of my favorites, Bombas.
I was babysitting the other day and the girl that I was babysitting, she's 10, and she was like, oh my gosh, Miss Brooke, look, those socks you like are on TV. And I looked at it was a Bombas commercial. And then she was like, oh my gosh, look what shirt I'm wearing. And she had on a Bombas shirt that I had given her. So she was super excited that she was immersed in Bombasness.
That's cool. I haven't seen the Bombas commercial, but I'm going to have to start looking for that.
I have the SeatGeek app on my phone, and it makes it so easy to buy tickets. I could be anywhere. And with just a few taps, I can instantly find seats. I actually just used SeatGeek to buy tickets for my mom for Christmas. I can't tell you what they're for just yet, just in case she's listening. But let's just say, she's gonna love it.
And it's just not about sports and Thunder games. They have all kinds of shows and production listed too. Plus, it saves me time and money because it compares multiple ticket websites for me.
I like that it gives each seat a grade, so I always know that I'm able to find the best seat in my price range. Plus, the tickets are guaranteed, so I can be confident with my purchases.
SeatGeek is my go-to app for finding the best deals on every type of ticket. I hope you get the SeatGeek app too and see how easy it is to use.
Best of all, our listeners get $20 off their first SeatGeek purchase. Just download the SeatGeek app and enter promo code ACTUAL today. That's promo code ACTUAL for $20 off your first SeatGeek purchase.
Here's the second half of our interview with Mr. Leslie Vass.
My cell buddy was a fellow named Hardy Hearn, and he had natural life in 45. Death Row, the actual death row tier, where all this was directly above where I was housed at. And the inmates on death row used to talk to us because there was a lot of young guys over there. The fellow Stanley Mitchell, he was one that was over there with me. The other fellow named Michael Austin, that a Maryland, another exoneree, but Michael Austin was older. He was like in his 20s. He was older than us, but he had been back and forth in and out institution. He was familiar with this process. I wasn't. I had a fellow tell me, he said to me, Shorty, what you in here for? He said, because I see you come out here, you don't deal with nobody. He said, all you do is walk. He said, you're going to walk, you can't walk the penitentiary down, you know? And this guy had been on death row, I think, like 15 years at that time. And he was an old guy. He was like in his 60s at that time. All I knew about him was that they called him Old Man Pipe Leg, right? And he was, before I found out about who he actually was, he was used to be an attorney in the state of Maryland. And I don't know what his crime was, whatever it was, he ended up getting a death penalty.
Man.
He actually gave me Article 27 of the Maryland Annotated Code and told me, first thing you need to do, Shorty, is learn that before you can do anything. He said, I understand that them people did you wrong. He said, they railroaded you, Shorty. He said, the lawyer threw you. He said, the lawyer threw you, and he don't care, you know, because that's what they doing to you kids out there now, you know? He said, because you black, and you come from the ghetto, and this is the attitude they have about you in Maryland's judicial system. Maryland, at that time, Maryland courts was known as the Maryland, the Supreme Bench for Baltimore City. Maryland had took on the attitude that they had the, they were the ones that like it was like that with them when it came to their what they could do in the court system. I have been dealing with the judicial system here in Maryland for over 40 years. I'm a certified paralegal. I am a employment specialist too. I have worked for the public defender's office for the state of Maryland, okay, as an intake specialist paralegal. I was the paralegal, paralegal assistant to the chief trial attorney for the public defender's office, Miss Natalie Finneker, right, who just recently retired from that office and went into private practice. I have a contract with the public defender's office through my business now, Legal Wizard 8, where I actually do investigations and serve subpoenas for them, okay? But in the course of me being inside the institution, I started learning how to do law. The first thing that I got was the original police offense report that told me the names of the men that I was actually supposed to be co-defendants with. Come to find out, the two men were at the Baltimore City Jail facility, which is the pretrial detention facility, when they went out on a weekend pass when they robbed this man. You know, everything that I found out through investigation while I was inside the institution. I was there in the penitentiary, and they sent me from there to Hagerstown, which is up in western Maryland counties of Maryland. And when I got there, I continued doing my research and all on my case. Also, I started playing basketball for the institution. They had an institutional team, and I played on that institutional team. And we used to have scrimmage games with University of Virginia, Virginia State University. Mm-hmm. And we used to beat them down. The coach, come to find out, had actually went to the courts to try to see if they could get me released, an early release to attend the college. You understand? Which they were doing here in Maryland at that particular time, back in those years. One of the fellows that was on the team with me, a guy named Isaac Moore, they got him out, and he ended up going over to D.C. and actually committed another crime while he was out. And they ended up come back to jail. But because of me receiving a sentence that they said they considered baby life at that time, right? You know, they refused to consider releasing me. I filed a complaint with the Attorney Grievance Commission for the state of Maryland against that trial attorney that I had for ineffective, inadequate counsel. I didn't want to say incompetent. You understand? He was a bar council member of the Attorney Grievance Commission. They refused to accept my complaint against Mr. Conrad. I then turned around and did a post-conviction. I did another post-conviction petition Okay, because I've had three separate post-conviction petitions. The first one, the public defender's office represents you on. The only way you get another one is if you bring about another case, bring about another issue that is of constitutional magnitude that has not been brought before the courts again. So I went in there again with the issue that he did not do any kind of investigation in regards to it, and he also waived my rights, a right that was not a fundamental right. I found out when after I was in prison for like 4 years that I was charged by way of criminal information and not indictment. Within the state of Maryland at that time, if you charge by way of criminal information, you have to have what they call a preliminary hearing. That preliminary hearing cannot be waived by inaction or by anyone else. Mr. Conrad actually went to court and waived my preliminary hearing.
So that was an in for another post-conviction?
They denied that, right? Okay. You know, because I'm saying, you know, this man had a lot of clout. He had a lot of clout. He was strong, you know. He was a racist, but he was strong. Come to find out, the judge that I was taking before, his son had been killed in a robbery just prior to me being tried, right? Before him, and...
Hold on, I didn't get that. The judge's son
the
was...
The judge's name was James A. Perrott, P-E-R-R-O-T-T. His son had been robbed and shot a couple weeks before my trial happened, before him. You know, I listening to people inside the institution, I never did, because I learned that, you know, I was in a place by myself. I was in an environment, you know, everybody was not guilty. That's all I heard. So, you know, wasn't no need for me to talk about mine. Only thing I could do was play basketball, stay out their way. As long as they didn't bother me, I wouldn't bother them, you know, and do what I had to do to try to get out. I got my AA degree by attending college inside the institution, and I earned enough credits to get my bachelor's, but I didn't get it until I came home after my court release in 1984, October the 17th, 1984. When I was inside the institution, the correctional officers that worked there that saw me when I went through the chains inside the institute in the courtroom, and they had to drag me out the courtroom, the officers came to me and said that they shouldn't have never had me tried before his court. And then they made the statement about his son being shot, you understand, in the course of a robbery. So then I talked with my mom, who was my sole provider and my sole support during the whole time of my confinement, because as I said, I was a mama's boy. I ain't had no girlfriends, nothing on the side. So I was SOL when it came to visits, except for my mom's, right? Every now and then, one of my childhood friends would come with her to visit with me. And every other week, faithfully, my mom's was there to visit me. I could see it was taking a toll on her, you know. And when I got like 8 years in, I was in what they call the Maryland House of Corrections and Jessup, the Cut, which was another facility just like the penitentiary. And when I was there, they said, I had filed a writ of habeas corpus in the federal court, because a fellow came to me and told me that the people that they mistake me for was a guy by the name of Bucky Nutt, right? And I said, is that his real name or is that a nickname? All the while I'm trying to get it, you know, but this fellow that told me this was his half-brother, right? And he told me his real name. And he said the reason why they don't use his real name is because he was an informant for the very same detectives that was in charge of investigating the robbery that I was accused of. So I was like, man, please. I said, you know how people come to you and they say things. But I'm saying this guy told me exactly who was on the charge with them. He explained to me that all three of them were actually over the jail at the time at a drug program called the Cash Program. You know, when they came home on a weekend and committed the robbery. The fellow explained to me that that part-time delivery driver had been setting it up, that he was one of the ones, they was split the money. So, I mean, I hid, but I don't want to put stock in this because I don't know these people. And I've been locked up 8 years at the time. So I send a photograph that he gave to me. He said, this picture was taken around the same time that they were all over the jail of his brother. And I sent that photograph to an investigator for the public defender's office. And it took them 2 years to send somebody out with that photograph because the letter that they wrote me back was that I was trying to find any and all errors to prove my innocence. And they commended me on my efforts and hoped one day that I would be successful. When the victim, I positively identified the man on the photograph, when the investigator carried the photograph to the victim, and the victim positively identified the photograph as the person who robbed him and said that he made a mistake when he misidentified me, They sent the letter back to me, and I was on segregation for 18 months at the time, you know. So they said to me that it would take me at least another year to 2 years before I could actually get a hearing because it was an election and it was a new state's attorney who actually came into office. His name was Kurt Smokes. Right? Mm-hmm. He was African-American. Man, everybody inside the Division of Corrections thought that this person, nobody wanted him to jump through hoops or nothing because the things that had been done over the years, we knew that they couldn't be undone. You understand? But at least we thought that we would get a fair shake when it came to him. This man came to the Maryland House of Correction. They had me brought from my cell down to the interview room, and he said to me, Eva, I accept the deal with them to plead nolo contendi to one count of the original information that was filed against me, and they release me with time served or take my chances with going before the judge who he was a close friend of, and, you know, who do I think he would believe?
So can you clarify what is a nolo contendi for the listeners?
Nolo contendi means I will not contest. They're going to read into the record. They're going to read into the record the stipulations, that what happened, and they're going to say that I admit that they have enough evidence against me to convict me, and I'm not going to contest it. In exchange, they're going to grant me time served with all the time that I had in. Yeah, that's what they did to these people up under that Unger decision. That's the game they played on all of them. But didn't nobody want to listen to me because I don't know no better, because you don't want to listen to me but you understand, I've been doing this. And I got myself out of the Maryland House of Corrections. I received a court release by Judge Robert Bell, the same judge that he said would not rule against him, because I wrote Judge Bell a letter and explained to him what the new state's attorney had said to me when he came to visit me. And he denied that he said it and all that kind of stuff. But the question that I presented to them was, what was your reason for coming to visit me? You know, that's ex parte communications. You wasn't the original state's attorney who was involved in my case. You are now the chief state's attorney. Then what they did, they messed up. They sent me a letter. And see, I was a paper hound. I keep paper. I still got all my documentation, my original documentation. You understand? And like I said, if you look at the video on YouTube, you'll see where he and I were on a program. And the victim called in. And he said that he said that he had made a mistake and that he was going to have me released. The victim called in and said that Mr. Smoltz said that they were going to charge him with perjury if he didn't say I was the person who actually committed the robbery, and said that they was going to charge the victim with perjury. The victim said, I made a mistake and I'm sorry. You understand? You know, and that program won the best, won the Frederick Douglass Award for the best urban affairs program in 1986.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsors. I noticed when we were in Chicago that you had a pretty awesome looking suitcase. Where did you get that, Brooke?
That was my away suitcase. It is awesome. It's durable, so I don't have to worry about my suitcase or the things inside of my suitcase while I'm traveling. Plus, it charges my phone and tablet and my long list of other things that are charged by USB because it has a built-in USB port.
Wow, I didn't know it did all that. Was it expensive?
It's made with such high-quality materials that you feel like you're using a luxury suitcase. But because they sell directly to you and not a middleman, it's actually a much lower price compared to other brands.
I noticed that it was green. That's my favorite color. But do they have any other colors?
Absolutely. You can choose from over 10 colors and 5 sizes, like the carry-on, the bigger carry-on, the medium, the large, or the kids' carry-on. I love when I see kids pulling their own perfect size suitcases at the airport. It makes them feel so responsible.
Well, I think I know what to put on my Christmas list this year.
Great idea. Away bags and accessories make the perfect gift. They have a lifetime guarantee and a 100-day trial. There's a perfect size and color for everyone on your list this holiday season. Or, if you're like me and you can't decide which design to buy, you can just grab an Away gift card.
So, remind me where I can get an Away suitcase.
Well, right now, we're part of a special offer. For $20 off a suitcase, just visit awaytravel.com/actual and use promo code actual during checkout.
That's awaytravel.com/actual and use promo code actual.
I came home to nothing. Yes, I did. I came home and I was 28. Didn't know anything about anything. Had no idea about budgeting, finances, what to do, how to do it, you know. Whatever. Nothing. I was lost. I'm saying, you know, and I wish this on nobody, and I'm doing this with y'all because I hope and pray that nobody who has experienced being wrongfully in prison will ever have to go through the things that I had to go through and learn as I had to learn.
That's really noble.
You know, coming along. You know, I have, you know, had no idea about how to go about getting employment. I didn't have no health insurance, no anything. I had a degree, you know, but I had skills too, trades and all that kind of stuff, certifications that I had gotten while I was confined, because I did everything that I could do to improve my own self so that once I was able to finally be free, that I would never, ever, ever have to find myself a victim of this system ever again for any reason, you know?
Sounds like you did. You spent your time constructively while on the inside.
I had to, because I want better for myself, you know? And the thing that really hurt is that all my friends that was out there in them Westport projects that they looked down upon, all those friends and all that they had bad negative feelings towards us, like we could not achieve and all that. Each one of them to this day, they are. If you look on my Facebook page, they you'll know who they are, because they're talking about Leslie. You still playing ball? You still look the same and all that kind of stuff, right? But what happens is they are real estate owners, own their own businesses. They have their own homes, you know. They have families. They have grandchildren. They have evolved. I have all my children were born since I've been home. I raised four by myself. My daughter, that's 17, she'll be 18, January 31st, Aledra graduates this year.
I think I saw a picture. Did you have a homecoming picture of her on your Twitter?
That's right. That's my baby.
I saw it. She's beautiful.
It's my baby. I'm proud of her. You know? My other daughter, Alicia, she lives in Anchorage, Alaska. I talk about her. And my grandkids, I got a slew of them. I don't even keep count. I got everybody kids is my grandkids, you know. But I'm really sorry about that I did not do was have the assistance or the opportunity to have an organization to network with and be a part of that actually cared about us or cared about me, you know, when I say that, because I have networked, I've dealt with Sean Armburst at the Mid-Atlantic Innocent Project. I actually was listed as a spokesman for their organization when they first started it, before she became the executive director, okay? I also have a friend. I said she's my friend and my other mentor. Her name is Lola Volin at the Life After Exoneration Organization in Berkeley, California.
I've heard of that. Who's the head of that?
Her name is Lola Volin. It's my heart. How far I had to go to get help, because these people here would not even acknowledge the fact that I was an exoneree and I was the first person who received compensation, who actually petitioned the state and received compensation for the time that I was wrongfully in prison and received the first pardon, full unconditional pardon that was issued by our governor here. The governor's name was Harry Hughes. I have a letter from him where he apologized and said that it was truly devastating to spend 10 precious years in prison for something that you did not commit.
When did you get that?
He wrote that letter to me back then.
Oh, okay.
In 1986 when I got the pardon document. Mm-hmm. They granted me the full unconditional pardon.
The governor apologized, right? Did any of the prosecutors or anybody else apologize?
Never. The part that I have a problem with is that the state's attorney, who actually was supposed to be trying to help me, that said, you know, he understood that it was wrong for what happened, and he felt as though, you know, it wasn't correct, that what took place, something wasn't adding up and all that. He knew that the fellow that I was mistaken for was an informant for the very same detective. He knew it. He found out afterwards. But he made it clear to me that, like he put it to me, his position as state's attorney is to protect the state the city and state from being liable for a lawsuit. That's it.
Money, but you received compensation, right?
And I received compensation. I received compensation because I found the statue that they had hidden in the public works law manual that had never been used before. And I used that that statue to go before the Board of Public Works and get compensated. But let me explain to you the problem that I had with that, and I still argue about that because I feel as though it's wrong. It's very wrong. If you've been in prison for any amount of time wrongfully, and the law states that if you provide us with a full unconditional pardon saying that you were convicted in error, and it was conclusively established that you were convicted in error, we can grant you from the general emergency funds compensation, right? Mm-hmm. That's what the law says, okay? Mm-hmm. What happens is the attorney general, who is not, he doesn't set the laws, he doesn't make the laws. They write into that you have to sign a waiver saying that you're not going to sue the state on a civil matter, mm-hmm. for you to receive compensation that the state law mandates that you get. I presented this same argument to the ACLU, the NAACP Legal Redress Committee, when Benjamin Hooks was the head of it, before they moved from Remsen Street here to Baltimore, Maryland. I left here one time, went to New York, stood up there in the rain. Hurricane Gloria hit up there, and I was stuck up there in the rain trying to get in to see the people at 60 Minutes in regards to what these people here in Maryland had actually did in my case, you know? But nobody wanted to hear that. Nobody wants to understand that even though I was in prison, I was there wrongfully. I wasn't one of those ones that did not understand. I did all that I could to stay on what I had to do to prove my innocence. I learned what was used against me wrongfully to take from me something that nobody should ever have to lose as I did. You know, I played basketball. I had the opportunity to play basketball. Any institutions that I ever been in, that's all they know me for. And they knew I was good. When the officers was betting on the games with other officers against other institutions, against all the other, you know, I'm saying we play games against. When I say this, and I'm not bragging, I'm just stating a fact. Mm-hmm. They played us against colleges and universities. They bring their teams in there, and we would beat them down.
I bet that felt good.
Seriously, I mean, I'm not joking. I'm not joking because that's what I like to do. I love to do that. That was something that I said Mike was good, but I'll do him real good. You know? Seriously. That's how I feel because that's where I was at mentally about what I wanted to do. But I was denied all that opportunity and then have to be out here and live the manner that I have been without being able to share my story so that people can know what actually happened. Kurt Smokes went on to become the dean of Howard University School of Law. No, excuse me. Let me go back and back up. He became the state's attorney here first initially. He left that position and became the mayor of Baltimore City. He sent me letters telling me he was going to meet with me so that he could try to make me whole to help me. So, but I was living in the best form that I could because I didn't have no guidance. I didn't have no understanding of what I did have. They gave me $250,000 and paid it to me like I was receiving a social service check once a month. You understand?
So you didn't,
once a month for 7 years, you know? I asked him.
So by receiving being compensated, right? So your record was
Well, in 1990, let me go back and update you on something. In 1998, I had been out here applying for an employment position, but I'm trying to use my bachelor's degree in sociology to get a position that's going to pay me, you know, because I knew I wasn't going to get it playing no basketball, old as I was now. So I try to supplement it by using the next skill that I thought I could utilize. But every time that I would apply for a position, I would get turned down, and it would always be a thing with, we sorry about what happened to you, Mr. Vass, and, you know, but it's still on your record. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, no, I got a first expungement order in 1986 that was done by the state's attorney himself, right? They walked it over to the courthouse, and the judge signed it. Judge Edgar P. Silver signed the very first order in May of 1986. That didn't go through. The clerk of the court, when I went down there to find out about it, he said, I wasn't putting it through because I think he made a mistake. Excuse me? Mm-hmm. You're going to tell me that the judge made a mistake? You're the clerk. All you're supposed to do is put it through. You understand? And I'm not saying something that I won't say to the person, because that's what happened. 1997, I sent a letter to the then governor of the state of Maryland, William Donald Schaefer, explaining to him that I've been applying for employment. Every time I turn around, I'm getting denied because this conviction is still on the record. They sent me a letter back saying that I need to contact the Secretary of Public Safety and Correctional Services, a fellow by the name of Bishop L. Robinson, whom I know. I send Mr. Bishop L. Robinson, the executive secretary, a letter. He, in turn, sends me paperwork to complete to return to him, which I did. He supposedly had someone take it over to a judge who signed it. So that's the second one, right? 1998. Still, I can't get a job because it's still on the record. So I said, well, I tell you what, we're going to stop this. I filed what they call a complaint and demand to the state treasurer's office for the state of Maryland, asking for compensation for the continued use of a record that should have been expunged. You know, the treasurer, a man by the name of Richard N. Dixon, actually called me and said, Mr. Vass, I am so sorry this happened. We're going to offer you the limits so that you can get yourself together and take care of your family and all. Okay. The limits is $50,000. Far cry from $1 million that I was at. Right? But I'm in a position where I have bills. I'm living under social service payments. You understand? Because my compensation is way gone, right? You know? So they give me the $50,000, and then I'm trying to make them do what they're supposed to do. I said, well, in my agreement with the state, I also supposedly gotten a job, the opportunity to get an employment if I qualified. So now they don't want no publicity, bad publicity, so they send me down to the state employment office, and I actually was eligible to work for up under state government. They put me in a position called employment placement specialist at the Maryland Department of Labor, Licensing, and Regulation. I go in there, I start working for them in January 1998. I start excelling. I start getting certificates, awards, going all out. I'm placing people what they consider hard to place at risk, individuals such as myself with a prior criminal record. All the individuals that I'm working with in the offices have been people who've been in the system for 15, 20, 25 years. They're sending their clients to me for me to place. I got people from the Mayor's Office of Employment Development sending their clients to me.
We're going to take a short sponsor break.
I put so much thought into picking out the right gifts for my friends and family for the holidays. It makes me happy to brighten other people's days. Last year, I got my teenage cousin a gift card for the phone he's pretty much glued to. But I put it inside one of those boxes that you have to figure out the puzzle to make it open. He actually really liked the challenge, and he was just as happy with the puzzle as he was with the gift. Sometimes, though, I don't have to look very far for gift inspiration, because the best gift idea is right in front of me, like my Bombas socks.
I've heard others say it, and I have to agree. Bombas are the most comfortable socks in the history of feet. They're made from premium cotton that will keep my feet warm this winter.
That's right, and they keep your feet cool in the summer. I just ordered the holiday pack that comes with a gift box for myself. They're so soft, and I love that they have the stay-up technology and the seamless toe. I wore them on my vacation to the happiest place on earth, and the innovative arch support was a lifesaver.
Well, they are the gift that keeps on giving, not only to your feet, but also Bombas donates a pair to someone in need for every pair that you buy. Bombas is helping all of us spread some holiday cheer because they have great discounts when you buy in bulk.
Don't forget the awesome gift boxes and holiday-themed socks. They even have ski socks.
Ski socks?
Buy the perfect gift for everyone on your list at bombas.com/actual today and get 20% off your first purchase.
That's Bombas, bombas.com/actual for 20% off. bombas.com/actual.
I think that that makes sense because you have compassion for these people and you know how to do it.
Yeah, because I've been there. I've lived it. I've lived all of it. So I then, I'm working there from 98. And again, I get another thing. Somebody say they did a background check and this arrest came up. No. I'm sorry. 2004. I go to work one day this morning in July. They tell me that, you know, they do what they call random checks of all state employees, you know, and the security said they did a random check of my name and I had a warrant for my arrest. So I'm like, warrant for my arrest? I thought the man was joking at first because he and I, we had a relationship. We cut the fool and laugh, joke and stuff. And I said, Mac, you lost your mind, man. You know, so I go on to my desk and sit down. He come over to my desk and he said, Leslie, look, he said, you got to get this taken care of. He said, because it is. He said, I'm not playing. So I said, okay. So I'm like, I'm dumbfounded at what's going on. I called to a person that I know who's a delegate and an attorney by the name of Kenneth Montague, right? He told me that he was going to have somebody check that's in the police department. They check, and they said, yeah, it's a warrant for your arrest for first degree attempted murder, first degree assault, and possession of weapons and all this other stuff. So I'm like, I said, nobody's been to my house. Nobody's been to my job. Everything is listed. I'm registered and everything in the state. You know, the state man, you went off, right? So he said, Leslie, he said, what do you want to do? I mean, what can I do? You know, I mean, I ain't done nothing, but I also know I didn't do nothing the first time either. You understand? But lo and behold, trying to be right and do the right thing, just imagine how I feel when I voluntarily turn myself in to the Baltimore City Police to arrest me for a so-called warrant that I know that I don't know anything about after going through what I went through with the state of Maryland. But I did. And you know the part that really hurt the most of it? Is that I had to place my children and foster care because I had no one to care for them because of some personal stuff with their own mother, right? I had to place my children in foster care. At the time, I worked at the state of Maryland as a employment placement specialist, and I also was a part owner to a bail bond business here called Action Bail Bonds, okay? So I took $80,000 in bonds when I turned myself in. When I went in there and they took me before the court commissioner, I explained to the court commissioner that, you know, I didn't know anything about this and that I surrendered myself because I wanted to get this matter resolved, that I had placed my children. I was hoping that if you were going to give me a bail, give me the bail so that I can get out, so I can get my children back out in the morning. They said, the commissioner started looking. She said, Mr. Vass, have you ever been convicted of a crime before? I said, no. You sure? I said, no, I haven't. She said, a felony. That's what she said, a felony. So I said, no, I haven't. So she said, I'm familiar with you, Mr. Vass. I'm familiar with your case. And she said, I'm going to turn this around and let you see it. She said, you need to go back and make them people pay you more money. She said, because the conviction is still on the record. This was in 2004, right? She said, because that armed robbery conviction is still on the record and the type of charge that you have, you understand, first-degree attempted murder, I can't release you on bail. You have to be held without bail. They held me for a year without bail. So all the while I'm over at the detention center, I'm trying to stay in contact with my children who've never been anywhere without me. You understand? You know? And you're talking about the mental part about what kids go through in the system. You know, I had to deal with all this and then trying to get myself together to get to court. And every time I'm going, they constantly postponing it and all this kind of stuff because they know they done messed up now. Mm. You understand?
Yeah.
The case they got against me is not a real case. Have you ever heard of somebody get charged with a murder or attempt murder and the detective that was in charge of investigating the murder or attempt murder don't want to come to court to testify?
Never.
Okay, well, they didn't in my case, and I had to force them to call the man, and then they had to track him down and force him to come in to testify. And then when he testified, they asked him, did he do an investigation in regards to the case? He said no. Well, how did you come up with Mr. Vass' name? The person, we was talking to someone else, and they mentioned Mr. Vass' name. You don't know if they were saying that I was a bail bondsman, I could bail them out or whatever. You understand? They claim I was somewhere that I was never at. I proved that I wasn't there. I had a 3-day trial. I had the trial. I got the trial on video. I've been saying to myself, I cannot believe the things that I went through here in the state of Maryland. But don't nobody want to listen to this. Don't nobody want to believe that it actually happened. You know, I've been told before that as long as I'm here, I'm never going to have any peace because they're never going to forget. They're never going to forgive, you know? And I believe that, and I understand that. So now, you know, those same people that you're interviewing, like Stanley and the other individuals that come from here in Maryland, I've networked with these people. Me and Stanley was together. I did a presentation out in Prince George County, Prince George County Community College out there near where he lived at. I didn't even know he was home. And I seen him, and the first thing he said to me, he said, I'm so proud of you, man. He said, one thing that I know about you, you don't give up. It's not about giving up. You know the sad part about it? In 2005, after I was found not guilty of all the charges that was lodged against me, when I got released to nothing. I had to come home and go stay in a shelter to actually start from scratch to get myself back into public housing so that I could get my children out of foster care. Then after I got them out of foster care, they started growing, you know, getting older and moving out on their own. We were living in public housing for 6 years. Then I actually moved from public housing into where I'm at now, right, which is a private home, right? And I'm receiving disability income, and I'm doing what I do with the business, you know, as much as you can, as long as it don't interfere with my benefits, okay? Mm-hmm. And it's, just imagine, should I be going through this? Is this the life that other exonerees going to have to face and all? You know? I mean, Definitely. These are things that I try to express so that others will know what the pitfalls are and what you have to be careful of, you know? And I hope and pray that if it's somebody that's still confined that's dealing with a wrongful imprisonment, they don't give up and keep on pushing to get out here.
I have a question. Were you compensated for that year that you was in the county for that?
Nope. I filed for the compensation for that. No, they said to me, Mr. Vash, you're lying. It's not on your record. It's none of that. But see, like I said, it's always the thing that I've experienced this with these people, and I know the games they play. Before I filed that complaint and demand with the state treasurer's office, I wrote 4 different letters to 4 separate institutions, right, giving them my inmate identification number, 134460. That was my ID number when I was confined. And the letter states, my name is Leslie Vass. I am presently presently residing in public housing, and I need a letter verifying the years that I was actually confined within your institution. My ID number was 134460. Every case manager specialist sent me a response back that they have records showing that I was serving 20 years. I received a court release, the date that I received the court release, and the date that I was received in the institution that I wrote to. I did an interview with WJZ TV 13 here in Baltimore right after I came home. And I took those letters and gave them to the reporter that was interviewing me. They went to the attorney general's office and showed them to the attorney general. And the attorney general said that must be a mistake.
You were 17 before all of this happened. Would you have called yourself a happy person or a person who was like motivated? How would you have described yourself at 17?
I was a kid that enjoyed simple things. I enjoyed sitting around joking and kidding with my friends. I have family members that lived in Bed-Stuy in Brooklyn, New York, on Fulton and, it's Fulton and Ralph, right? And Bed-Stuy projects up there. I used to travel from here to there. I enjoyed naturally basketball. I like to play chess. I enjoyed simple things. You know, I had a lot of, you know, I had more peace within me than I've ever had, you know. And at one point in my life, I really thought that once this wrongful imprisonment case was over and I regained my freedom, that it would be done and over with. But, you know, I just turned 60 years old, and it's still a stressor. You know, I'm going to be honest with you. I fear something. Something just happened just recently that caused me to really take a look at what's going on, what is actually happening in my life, and what this conviction has actually done. I had a friend of mine that I met His name was John Thompson, down in New Orleans. Call him JT. He's the fellow that served the 18 years in Angola State Prison, 14 years on death row. On wrongful conviction day, he and I was on the phone talking and joking and stuff, right? You know, in the morning, we was, you know, kicking it on the phone. He was born September the 6th. I was born September the 7th, you know. They flew me down there to New Orleans. I stayed a week down there. I met Glenn Ford when he first came home. I met quite a few of the New Orleans exonerees. All of us is close. You know what I mean? I call myself the grandfather of exonerees because, you know, this way I've been. I've been out here this long. So when I was in here, I got a phone call, and it was Kurt Bloodsworth. And he said, Leslie, he said, you know, have you heard about JT? And I was like, what you mean have I heard about him? I said, I was on the phone with him a little earlier, Kurt, you know? And he was like, man, he said, you know, JT just died, man. I was like, what? What? I have, within this period of time, the last couple of years, I know I've heard of maybe 10 different people that I've known that have passed away who've been wrongfully in prison, you know? And I be like, you know, I know it's coming because it's inevitable that I do pass because that's life. You live to die. And I don't have a problem with that. God is good, you know, because I'm going to see it out here in the streets. It's not going to be behind no bars, you know. But the thing about it is that the stigma of having this label still burdened on you is something that I don't want. I don't want that. You know, I got children. I got a son. You know, I got sons. I talk to them and I be like, look, you know, I say, I'm striving, you know, to do everything I can in a positive manner. I don't want nobody to ever feel like I'm not compassionate to, you know, what they feel and what they're trying to do. If I can do what I can to help, as far as like on someone's case and all that, I do. I've networked with a lot of people. Sabrina Butler, I've networked with. I can't name everybody.
I'm taking out of what you're saying that your record has not been.
No, it's. Let me tell you something. Are you familiar with LexisNexis? Okay, LexisNexis is a legal platform that is used by more experienced people in the legal field all over the United States, all over in different other countries and all, right? What I'm going to do is I will actually go up here. I already did it. I did it too many times, and it really bothers me because the first time I just had it applied on my computer here, and I put my name in the computer, right? You know, hopeful, you know? And it pulled up the case. It pulled up the wrongful imprisonment case. It's not supposed to be no mention of that. It's not supposed to. It's not. After Maryland's law is 3 years from the date of an order being issued for an expungement, all reference and records relating to that conviction is supposed to be destroyed. I got 4 separate expungement orders. When they going to destroy it? I got a letter from the FBI saying they destroyed it. They no longer have this. It's been expunged from their records, you know? But, you know, the state of Maryland tell me that I'm not telling the truth about it. I said, wow, even when your own workers call, send letters to me, notarized, saying that it's in their computers, in their state computers. Something wrong with that. I don't wish that on anyone, you know.
Can I ask, so what advice would you give to someone who might just be now being convicted of a crime they didn't commit, or have just been, you know, incarcerated for a crime they didn't commit? What's your advice to them?
Honestly, it would be to learn as much as you can in reference to your case. Try to get all your documentation that you can get, you know. And one of the main things, stay focused, keep faith. Keep faith first. Because when everything else gone, believe me, faith is going to be what's holding you, you know. I'm not holier than I am. I ain't trying to profess that or none of that, because I go out here, my kids get on my nerves, I cuss them out, you know what I'm saying? Because I'm real. I straight up. They're my babies, you know what I'm saying? But it doesn't get to a point where it's out overboard, you understand?
Right.
But what I'm saying is, a person, if, you know, God forbid, I would hate to see anybody have to deal with anything relative a wrongful imprisonment case these days, because it doesn't seem as though it's getting any better. It's getting worse, you know? And the other thing about it is that we're not celebrities. I don't care who it is, how much money you get, where you come from, what your status is, you're not a celebrity. You're a victim. You are a victim, you know?
And being a victim doesn't mean you're weak. It just means that someone did something to you that was unfair.
I got you. But see, you have some that mistake that when they think they take, instead of realizing that it's about, they blessed to be able to be out here, you know? If someone else, reach one, teach one.
Amen.
You know, you got others that are still fighting and struggling to get where we are. Don't forget them. I'm not saying you got to reach out to everybody. No. What I'm saying is, don't forget. Because you know the pain that you went through. I do.
I do too.
You know what I'm saying? I understand, bro. I understand. I read it. You know? You understand? I know. I do a lot of reading. You know? And I pray that, you know, those that are out here carry on the strength, you know, of, you know, helping others and bettering the system that we have, you know? Because we have to. If not, it's going to be a loss. It's going to be a great loss, because so many can fall prey to this, and it doesn't take a whole lot to be wrongfully in prison.
I have one more question for you, and then if DeMarco has any more, I'm a social worker. Like I do a podcast now. How do you think regular people like me, people who don't have training, can help people who have been wrongly incarcerated?
I want to word it in the right manner, because, you know, I understand this. Let me tell you something. One of the first and foremost things that I feel a person who has been wrongfully in prison should receive is counseling. Individual and group counseling.
Definitely.
And I mean, until they decide that they feel as though they don't need that assistance, that counseling, then I would be, you know, reaching for that to be included, you know, in their life, because it's gonna be needed. Look, I've been home 40 years. Let me tell you something. I went and got counseling, not because I felt that I was getting to act crazy or anything, but because I needed help to deal with all that I was dealing with. It's not something that you can deal with by yourself. And people who are counseling individuals who have been wrongfully imprisoned have to understand they have to be a little patient and mindful that we're going to have mood swings. We're going to go through things and keep things in. You know, we're not going to want to share a lot of things right off the bat because we're not used to talking to people. I don't care what. I got a young lady. We've been together for 11 years. Some things I just don't feel comfortable talking to her about. We joke and kid and everything. But when it comes down to certain things, I'll be like, baby, you know, I really got something on me today. You know, she'll be like, well, what do you want to talk about? We'll get back to it, you know. It's not that I don't trust her. It's just that, I mean, what I really feel, there's something that me and JT was doing down at Resurrection after Exoneration, down at Ray House that he started in New Orleans, is that we was doing the counseling thing where all the guys that was in the Ray House used to get around, sit around and talk at the end of the week, you know. If we needed to talk before then, maybe we do it twice a week, you know, as a group, talk about the things that's going on, what we dealing with, the changes that we sent. You know, I mean, because it'd be real weird things. You'd be like, man, I ain't never seen some of the crazy stuff these people do, you know. Then you got to remember an institutional mindset that you have been accustomed to for 20, 30, 40 years is not going to automatically change in a couple of years that you're out here. I can say that from personal experience. Look at me.
It's become a part of you.
There it is.
Before I even ask you this question, I just want to commend you on, you know, you've been doing a lot. You've been staying busy, doing a lot of positive things. And, you know, I love hearing stories like that. You know, I know it's a struggle because it's still a struggle for me. I only been out a year and a half.
Really?
After 22 years, I went in at 17 and got out at 39. And it's definitely a struggle for me. But just hearing what you've been going through and, you know, how you maintain your, you know, your outlook on life, you know, a positive outlook on life. You know, I commend you on that, and you're doing a lot of positive things.
We've been into what we call the belly of the beast.
Mm-hmm.
We walked the walk, and we survived, okay? If we cannot make it out here, then something's wrong. You understand?
Oh, I do understand.
We got to apply ourselves in a positive manner. We got to give us a chance, man. I swear, you know, let me say something, bro. It ain't no giving up, you know, because I know I can make it. Mm-hmm. I know I can. When the moments when them little situations come up and I dwell back on the things that I could have been doing, the things that I should have been able to do, I stop thinking about it and say, you know what, guess what? I did good already because I'm here. Mm-hmm. As long as I'm here, I got a chance. Every day, if God give me the opportunity to open my eyes, I have a chance to make it work.
I'm going to stay positive, stay doing, you know, whatever I feel I have to do to pay it forward, reach one, teach one, and, you know, hopefully I save a life and, you know, prevent someone from going through what we've been through.
That's it.
Yeah, but my question is, my question is to you is, have you ever been to an innocence conference?
No, because I've never been invited. Oh, wait a minute. You said innocence conference?
An innocence conference.
No. I've been to the public defenders, the Federal Public Defenders Conference as a speaker. I've been to university conferences for speaking engagements where I've spoken, but I've never been to an innocence conference. I've never known that they had an innocent conference until this year when I happened to see it on Facebook. And I was pissed off. Excuse me. I really was. I was really pissed off about it because, what's his name, Marty?
Mm-hmm. I know who you're talking about.
You know what I mean? I was like, you know, man, I said, it's really crazy, man. I said, you know, we all exonerees all across the United States, man. We can communicate with each other on this social network and stuff, and like each other pages and all that kind of stuff and whatever's going on, but we can't let each other know when certain things, events come up so that we can all try to be there, you know? I mean, it doesn't take much, you know, just to let somebody know. For us to be informed, you know, it should be a network of all exonerees to all the Innocent Projects, Centurion Ministries, those that were that did their own cases, such as myself, anybody that's been an exoneree, anybody who's been wrongfully convicted, confined, whatever label they want to put on it, we need to network with each other because with the numbers, it's strength.
Amen.
Yeah, really. Believe that, man. You know, that's something that I did back in 89. It's called the Exoneration Bill, right? Lola Volan from Life After Exoneration in Berkeley, California, she and I sat down and did a actual bill. We did the research and all and put together a bill. At that time, it was maybe between 300 exonerees that was listed all across the United States, right?
Yeah.
You know? And that bill was gaining support, right? The person that was actually sponsoring the bill, I forget the senator's name out there in California that she had doing it, but he passed away. And when he passed away, nobody picked it up from there, right? But it spoke about this, what we're talking about now, about exonerees having conferences and being able to network with each other and support one another, man, you know? Because, you know, it's vitally needed, bro. It is, because you got to look at it. As many as it is now, just imagine how many more it'll be in another 10 years.
And Leslie Voss was a very good guy that, you know, once you hear his story, you'll be compelled to want to reach out to him and, you know, help him in whatever way that you can, because he's just a genuine, nice guy that, you know, you feel compelled to help.
Yeah, and he's on Twitter. So if any of the listeners are on Twitter, find me at Brooke Giddings and I will tweet out his Twitter handle. And also, Leslie, like Salam, is hoping to go to the Innocence Conference. So if you would like to contribute to that, just email us at the email in the show notes and I will pass on your information.
We'd love to have Leslie at the Innocence Conference 2018 in Memphis.
So until next time. Thank you so much for listening. Actual Innocence is hosted by DeMarco Carpenter and Brooke Giddings. Our original music is by Blake Maples. Our transcriptionist is Christina Judge. Our website guru is Sean Cole. Our social media superstar is Cameron Taylor. And our amazing volunteer is Casey Weber. You can visit our website for bonus materials like transcripts, pictures, and a calendar of upcoming episodes.